Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
She is strange, so are the plays of Brendan Behan, Jean Genet, and Bertolt Brecht. She is far out and at the same time common, so are Raw Eggs and Worcestershire and The Connection. She is different, so was Billie Holiday, St. Francis, and John Donne. So is Mort Saul, so is Ernie Banks. She is a club member, a colored girl, an Afro-American, a homie from down home. She has hit the big town and the big towns, the LP disc and the TV shows. She is still from down home. She did it mostly by herself. Her name is Nina Simone. Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. You just listened to me read from Princess Noir, a new book by Nadine Cujadas, about the tumultuous reign of Nina Simone. Langston Hughes and Nina Simone were wonderful friends, and he wrote that about his wonderful friend. It shows all the different sides of her. I thought it was apropos for today. And I have the author on the line. Good morning, Nadine.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining the show this morning. This was an immense research project that you decided to do. Why did you decide to do a book about Nina Simone? You know, she already has her own biography. What made you think you had something else to say about her?
That is a very good question and a daunting question. the way you put it, I wrote this book as an outsider. The previous book I had done was about Dinah Washington, and it mm-hmm. seemed to me that the next step in my interest, which is to explore the intersections of race and culture, made Nina Simone someone worth looking at, and of course it has to start with the music, which is so compelling, and her personality, and I think that by the time one gets to Nina Simone, if you start back with Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday, etc., when you get to Nina and the time in which she lived, her identity and her pride in being an African American and her art were all bound up together, and I found that to be fascinating and, as I say, worth exploration.
Well, I think you did a wonderful job. I myself learned things that I didn't know before, so that's why I loved the book and I wanted you to come on, because I think it does give more detail. We mentioned, we talked earlier right before the show started about you made several trips to her hometown. I just want to read a little bit. This is just from the beginning right here of the book, the first chapter. And one of the unique things you did is some of your chapters either are from her songs, words from her songs, or plays on the titles of her album and stuff. So that was a nice touch. But the beginning here, the first chapter, called for and delivered. The gifts that would turn Eunice Wayman into Nina Simone were apparent by the time she was three. Though the passions, the mood swings, and the ferocious intensity that marked her adult life were buried for years under her talent, she was born on February 21st, 1933, the sixth of eight children in Tryon, North Carolina, a town perched at the border between North and South Carolina on the southern slope of the Blue Ridge Mountains. So she wasn't born Nina Simone. She started off as Eunice Wayman, and she's a Pisces. I'm a Pisces, and Pisces are very sensitive. I'm born February 23rd. So I felt for her throughout the book, because you do bring up the issues of her mood swings, her walking off of stage, her reprimanding the audience for not having proper etiquette when they came to see a musician. So you do bring all that. But one of the nice things is her relationship with her father. That was a very beautiful thing. Her father had gotten ill at one point, and she was kind of taking care of him. But also later in life, she had bought a beautiful car, and she would only let her father drive it. Talk to me a little bit about her relationship with her father.
Yes, you're entirely right about that. You know, what I tried to bring out is to put myself, and I hope the reader, into this small town in western North Carolina, and try to help people understand what it would be, what it was like to be a young black girl with talent and in this family, and how you made your way through life, how you negotiated the color line, and with respect to J.D. Wayman. You know, he was really quite an entrepreneur, and, you know, when you read the title of the first chapter, Called For and Delivered, he had a dry cleaning business, and I thought that was so wonderful, because does it not have overtones of religion and going to church? Called For and Delivered, as in this is my calling, and there's a number of ways to look at that. Nina's mother, Eunice's mother and father, were involved in the church, and her mother even more so, and her talent, you know, surely came from both sets of parents, but her father was a wonderful musician when he was a young man, and as her older brother Carol said, he had the ability to whistle two notes at once. And when Eunice's mother, Kate Wayman, actually became a minister, she did not want anything that wasn't religious music played in the house. But Nina's father loved all kinds of music, and so when they were home alone,
so they would hide and play the music.
Yes,
that was so beautiful. You know, that's I think that's so important, that connection there, and that's what lifted her, it seems, throughout different times in her life. Because there are different moments where you bring up the mother really not supporting her, and her just yearning, really just one, I think it was like one word from her mom would just kind of be a sob, you know, a balm to the pain that she might have. She just wanted some words from her mom.
Yes, that is correct. And you know, the interesting thing about Nina's beginnings, and you know, maybe some of your listeners or readers online may know this. It is, there are a number of wonderful musicians who came out of the church experience, and I think, you know, I had the great and wonderful challenge to do a book on Dinah Washington, and her beginnings were the same. And if you listen to these musicians and others like them who came out of the church, in my view, it never really leaves them. And even when you listen to their music in later years, you can't help but pick up a gospel touch or something that might have a call and response to
yes,
it.
And
I think, too, what you get from that experience is a kind of immediacy. And you know, Eunice's first experience is playing the piano before she became a singer. And I think we might remind the audience that in her early years, you know, Eunice's talent was recognized, and this is what was special about Tryon. It was a haven for northern artists and
yeah,
really a much less ferocious place for a black family to live than the Mississippi Delta, for example, or a tiny
town
in Alabama.
Right. Nadine, right. Let me just bring up the issue that where she was born and let her beginnings of her classical piano playing. She actually wasn't a singer. She didn't even think of herself as a singer until a little later. I guess it was about her early 20s. She didn't really think of herself as a singer. But her first, I would say, first couple of love affairs, let's talk about that. First love affair, Muriel Mazanovic. talk to the audience about her.
Yeah, yes, Miss Mazzy, as Eunice called her, what I was leading up to, as you noted, is that some white women in Tryon recognized Eunice's talent. In fact, it was the woman for whom Kate Wayman worked as a cleaning lady during the day, and then, you know, in the evening and on weekends, she was a minister, who said, you know, it would be just a crime not to nourish this talent, and she agreed to pay for piano lessons for Eunice with Miss Mazzy, Muriel Mazanovich. And through Miss Mazzy, Eunice got a scholarship to a private high school for young
black
girls.
Now, that was amazing. That was absolutely amazing. I mean, I myself didn't even know that that type of school existed at that time. The private school for a young black girl, absolutely amazing opportunity for her. And that brings me to another of her first loves, Edney. We all can remember our first love. As a matter of fact, when she was married with her second husband, he was upset that she still had letters from Edney. Talk to the audience a little bit about that relationship she had with Edney.
Well, you pretty much gave a good introduction. he was a young man who belonged to the same church, and Eunice was just struck by him, and I had the great and wonderful good fortune to talk to Edney, and I was just so sorry that he became very ill out of nowhere and died quite unexpectedly before the book came out. But for anyone who picks it up, you will find his direct reminiscences of the afternoons they would spend together. He was a little older, and when he got a car, they would drive out in the countryside, and he loved to buy her ice cream cones, and she loved to eat it, and they loved to make music together in the house, although when Kate Wayman came around, they learned, just like with her father, to
hide
quickly from the secular to something more sacred, and you're certainly correct that the concept of Edney, if you will, and maybe even the fantasy of Edney, you know, stayed with Eunice and then Nina for the rest of her life. And this, you know, I would just like to bring up another transition that is related to Miss Mazzy and to Edney. You know, he realized that Eunice was destined for something larger than Tryon. I mean, he lived his entire life there. Through Miss Mazzy, Eunice got a scholarship for 6 weeks of study at the Juilliard School of Music in New York, which was absolutely a terrific experience. And once Eunice left for New York and this very formal study, you know, she was really on her way to something larger and bigger than Tryon, North Carolina, what was going to offer.
Let's talk, Nadine, I just want to interrupt you a little bit. So she went to Juilliard, and she had a wonderful experience. She had some great teachers there who had got trained by other famous artists. But she only got like B's in there, and that was a bit of a shock for me when I read that she only got like B+ or something. But then she tried to prepare to go to Curtis Music School, and there's a rich history of her family here in Philadelphia. I'm based in Philadelphia, so that was great to read about Northwest Philadelphia. And even then, her father was just an entrepreneur, starting up, you know, barbershop, teaching her brother to do different things. But she did not get into Curtis Music School. Talk to the audience about that.
Yes,
that was a
That was a devastating disappointment, because in her mind, you know, Eunice had trained with the idea that she was going to become a classical pianist. And when she was rejected by Curtis, and the special thing about Curtis is that if you are admitted, it is a full scholarship until you're done. And when she was rejected, as I say, it was a devastating disappointment. But in fact, that launched her on the path to becoming Nina Simone, because she needed to earn money, and after taking a break from all kinds of music, she finally realized she missed it, and her older brother Carol could see that too, and he encouraged her to do something that got her back to music. She was teaching private lessons, and event accompanying kids who wanted to sing, and one of them told her he had gotten a job in Atlantic City, New Jersey, not
making
far.
Making all that money, you know.
Yeah. And so she decided to go and see if she could get work, which she did at the Midtown Bar and Grill. And indeed, that is when Eunice Wayman transformed herself into Nina Simone, temporarily thinking that she couldn't. There was no way she could tell Kate Wayman that she was out earning money in a bar. And so right there in the moment when the owner said, well, you know, how do you want to be billed? You know, that's when Nina Simone came to her. And if I could just take just a half second here, I did go to Atlantic City and go to the library, and it was just one of those wonderful eureka moments to go through the entertainment pages and there see the ads for the Midtown Bar and Grill, one of which is reproduced in the book, that shows us with our own eyes, indeed, there is the first mention of Nina Simone.
Nina Simone. Now, that's Atlantic City was also another important point in her life because she met her first husband. She was married twice. She was married to Don Ross for several years, and then she married Andy later in life, who was a policeman. Both relationships very tumultuous. Don seemed to, I guess, she was very lonely. That was one of the issues
in
the book.
She said to
she was
he
very
was,
lonely.
You know,
she wanted company. She didn't want to get married.
Yeah, the thing that you know, Don seems so interesting, and even her younger brother Sam, I mean, he was a white man, and he fancied himself kind of a beatnik, and what at first seemed attractive, as Nina said later, you know, he was kind of a high class bum when she started being successful.
You know,
he was living off what she was doing, but you're entirely correct. You know, a theme through her entire life was indeed this feeling, you know, of being lonely. And I thought, you know, one of the great poignant things, even at moments of great success, she couldn't find a way for that to give her all the sustenance that you think it could or should. And that's, you know, that, as I say, that is just
a
poignant thing.
I agree completely. Yeah, I mean, people think I'm going to get the money, I'm going to get the fame, and even when you're able to do your passion, if at the core there's a hole, sometimes those things are just not big enough to fill it up. I mean, she loved doing her music. She seemed alive doing it and bliss, and sometimes you talk about her eyes being closed. But also, she was married twice, but all you mentioned about her lesbian relationships. And it's funny, after I read through the book almost three-quarters away, I kind of went back to when she had brought the prostitute to her house.
Oh, yeah, Kevin.
And I was wondering, did she at that time have a relationship with that woman, even though
it wasn't said? I cannot speak to that. You know, people remembered Kevin and what a striking individual she was, and how Nina talked about her is just, you know, admiring that great self-confidence. But I'd like to go back to a point that you made that I think we must not forget, that the reason that, you know, you were so kind to have me come on to talk about Nina is just the wonderful and compelling and important music she left behind. And to me, how this ties together is the things that we just talked about is what makes that music so compelling. When you listen to it 20, 30 years after it was recorded, or in the case of a live album, you know, a live album performed, you can feel that emotion. I think it's part and parcel.
In the chat room, one of the listeners said "To Be Young, Gifted, and Black" was one of their favorite songs. Some of her most powerful songs. Well, she started off the most popular in the beginning was "I Love You, Porgy."
Yes,
that was her jump start song.
And I think it's interesting. It's interesting to note that unlike some other singers, Nina's first audience was a white jazz audience. And then as you know, a turning point for Nina in what she wanted to do with her art and who she became in the 60s was that some terrible September morning in 1963 when white supremacists planted a bomb at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, and those four young girls were killed. Yes, exactly. And from then on, you get to be young, gifted, and black through Mississippi Goddamn, and then, you know, a song like Old Jim Crow, but also Four Women, which
Four
is
women.
Just an extraordinary
song.
She got a lot
of flack. She got amazing flack about Four Women and from the African-American radio producers and things. They didn't want to play the song. They banned the song. So it's just amazing. She that was the pain she was feeling. I think that she was accepted maybe by the white community. Like you said, she started off that way. And then the fight to get respect from African Americans, and that leads us to her flight over to you know, Paris and the Netherlands and London, and how she was so embraced. Your chapter with that starts. It's called Respect. Actually, you call that chapter Respect.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting too that, you know, after 1974, you know, after Nina and Andy broke up and were formally divorced, Nina really didn't live for any length of time in the United States after 1974. She, in fact, bought a condominium in Los Angeles and certainly came back to perform, but she never came back with a deep sense of comfort here, even though she was wonderfully received and had legions of fans. And in fact, her last days were spent in the south of France and in a house.
She died. She had breast cancer. And I'm not sure if a lot of people know about that she had breast cancer. And then you mentioned about her stroke. So it was kind of a painful. I almost. My eyes kind of watered up, like, wow, you know, okay, you got all this happening, and then, you know, she had issues with taxes and money. A lot of artists have that problem trying to get their royalties, but then to get breast cancer, that's something completely out of your control. I felt, you know, such, I really was just moved, and I think my eyes watered up to read that part, like, goddamn, like, why did she have to have breast cancer after all this? Couldn't she just die in peace, you know, type of thing? So you did a wonderful job at bringing out emotions in me. She did have some wonderful friends on her life. Lorraine Hansberry, she was very close to. Yes. Langston Hughes, she was close to. Miriam McCabe drew
right.
her to
oh,
Africa.
And don't forget James Baldwin. You know, that's why,
James,
right,
yes.
In the opening page of the book, I believe I call them her circle of inspiration.
And now one thing I found out recently was that Mary J. Blige might be playing her in a movie coming out in 2012. Have you heard of any rumblings of that?
I only know what you know. I've read about it, and you know, anyone is free to put together any kind of project that they want.
One of the things that was nice, though, there was a peaceful period, I guess, after she had her daughter. She has her daughter is named Lisa, who now goes by Simone and is also a singer. But that seemed like a quieter time in her life. So that was beautiful.
There were a couple years there where it just seemed, you know, exactly like what you would hope for. And there's a couple of pictures in there from that moment. And, you know, thank goodness Langston Hughes, bless him, wrote a lot of letters and saved a lot of letters that he received. And the section of his papers that include Nina Simone were just a wonderful source for me of both his personality, but also some of the letters and the cards that Nina wrote to him. And of course, at bottom, it was evidence of their great friendship. And I would just say to anyone, Nina cared for him deeply. And when you listen to her, you know, talk about him often in the introduction to Backlash Blues, you can feel the importance of that friendship. You know, when she explains how Langston gave me this, and he said, you know,
yeah,
Nina, once
yeah.
the door is open, you know, we've got to keep going.
One of the things I wanted to read, this is from a later chapter, Fodder on Her Wings, which, as I mentioned earlier, the titles of the chapters in your book bring in some of her songs or titles to her album. And that was the album titled Fodder on My Wings. This is a quote from your book here. It's about a bird that fell to earth and was crippled when it landed in fodder and other human debris, Nina explained. Although it was able to survive, it couldn't fly. So it walks from country to country to see if people had forgotten how to live, how to give. As it went, the bird found that most of the people had forgotten. I thought that was just very poignant, and to me it really encompassed a lot of her. That little phrase there encompassed her being a bird, trying to find its way, you know, falling down with all the drama, because she was very involved in the civil rights. We only have about 5 minutes left, but she was very involved in the civil rights movement. Not at first, but Lorraine Hansberry seemed to be the catalyst for her getting involved. And she protested artists having to have passes to work in certain facilities. She, you know, and she just did a lot of amazing things through her music. I think you did a wonderful job, Nadine, in the book. What do you hope that people will get from the book?
The most important thing would be finding it a good read, and a sense of the importance of Nina Simone to our culture, both musically and culturally, and that there was more to this story than just anger, that there is a particular kind of musicianship that was unique. We really don't have anyone quite like her. Perhaps some of that was the time in which she lived, but you know, again, what was special and so interesting to me was this fusion of one's identity into one's art.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. And I also want to let the audience know that you'll be giving away a couple of copies of Princess Noir. So if you're interested in getting a couple of copies of the book, you need to email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com, the name of the town where Nina Simone was born. We mentioned it a couple of times in the interview today, but again, the name of the town where Nina Simone was born. Email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Thank you so, so much, Nadine, for coming on today, and I wish you much success with this book and all your future endeavors.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Okay, you have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening today. Just got off the phone with Nadine Cojudas, a beautiful author, wrote a new book, Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. You need to pick up a copy. You will learn some new and exciting and sometimes sad things about our wonderful Princess Noir. Some of the things that are said: Nadine Cojudas' superb biography restores the luster of Washington's crown, detailing a life lived not always wisely, but certainly with vigor. That is about her other book, Queen, about Dinah Washington. She is a wonderful writer and just picks up a lot of detail. So you want to pick up some of her writing, not just about Nina Simone, but also about Dinah Washington. I'll be giving away some copies. Email me, what town was Nina Simone born in, at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'll be doing a second show in a couple minutes about eating disorders, so please stay tuned. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. Thank you so much for joining the show today.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.